If you enjoyed the channel and our video content and would like to support us, you can do this in a couple of ways. You can sign up to our Patreon site, which is a monthly subscription to one of our four tiers, each giving you something different, from early access interviews up to exclusive unseen footage. There's also the option of a one-off donation via PayPal, which allows you the option to donate an amount of your choice. Both options really help to keep this channel going and to continue putting out regular content for you good folk. So please take a look at aircurrentreview.tv/donate, and I thank you in advance. Thank you and enjoy. So John, let's talk about Green Flag. Tell us about what the exercise is all about. Was it true that this was the first GR1 on the exercise?
It was, yeah. It was supposed to be Red Flag, but with electronic warning issues. And since I never went to Red Flag, I'm not quite sure what the differences were, but it seemed to me the same as it normally is. So we went there. That was our first go on the Tornado. So anyway, you arrive there, and of course it's massive. There are airplanes all over the place. I don't want to exaggerate, but I seem to remember 160 airplanes in what they called a gorilla. It was called a gorilla, yeah. All these airplanes. And especially at Nellis Air Force Base, because one of the runways, when you took off from there, it went over the town, and you couldn't use that one. So often you find aircraft going opposite directions, and it was... I wish I could find it now. It was a tape. And it was a tape of the air traffic control. And if ever you've heard good air traffic control, you've heard nothing as good as this. Unbelievable. People just talking. All aircraft all over the place, all different types of airplanes, everything else. And I'm told that the way they did it was because eventually he dried up. They used to have somebody behind him, and the moment he dried up, he sat down and this next guy started speaking. And then they did this.
Yeah.
But it was... It was a lot of airplanes. Unlike, for example, when we did the SAC bomb competition, we did integrate with the Americans a lot. We were all in the same area and everything else. We tended, for whatever reason, which I don't know, we didn't go out with them subsequently, but we're certainly there. And in fact, when we got there, this... young guy, he was F-16 pilot. I know he was going on about the F-16 and this and that, and he said, "And we've got this jamming pod, and it's the XYZ, and it's the latest version, and we're going to kick ass, take names." And my heart sank, because I thought, our kit is useless at this. It really is. We've tried it everywhere. It doesn't bloody work, you know. Oh, nothing could be far from the truth.
Yeah.
Our kit was brilliant.
And what was the kit?
Well, it was a Sky Shadow pod and a Boss chaff and flare dispenser.
Yeah.
Right, the outboard pods. And the jamming pod was absolutely brilliant. And we know this because what happened was, in the debriefs, they would show what the Russian radars were seeing, because they were all Russian kit, and what they were actually seeing on their radars. And the F-16, this fantastic F-16, yeah, it sort of jammed it, and you'd see lots of sort of shimmering on the radar. But with the Tornado, gone. Nothing. You couldn't see a thing.
Really?
Yeah. It was great. So much so that we got a call from the radar operators, and they said, "Look, would you mind doing the last day using your radar," which we didn't do. We'll come on to that in a minute. So we didn't have our radars running all the time, so they couldn't pick you up from there. And they said, "And also, don't jam, so we can see what your radar signature is, because up till now we haven't seen it." So we did that. We just did some runs for them to do that. Oh, it was amazing. And the chaff and flare dispenser, well... the world's chaff was in this damn thing. I mean, it just went on forever. And the other thing, which you can't practice in peacetime very much, I realised how much the order audible stuff is the important stuff. Yeah. You don't see anybody really, because everybody, you know, it's bloody miles away and these tiny aeroplanes and things. It's the audible. So you could very quickly, one day, and you could tell the search radar of the F-15, which is what was after you, and then you'd get the lock on and off you go with your chaff and flare dispenser and, you know, away you go. And again, there's the F-16s and so on, and you got to learn, you knew who was who and what was what very quickly, in a way that you don't in peacetime. The other thing about Green Flag was that you're flying quite low and you're going quite fast, and you have, as I say, this great gorilla of aircraft, and you get being attacked all the time, which you don't normally get in peacetime. And it was then that I sort of realised that I am driver's airframe. The important guy is the guy in the back.
You're the monkey with the stick.
Yeah, I'm just the guy that just gets this thing from A to B and get told what to do. But now, you're concentrating because you're flying low and you're flying quick and so on. But he's the boy. And he dictates traffic and he runs all the chaff and flare dispensers and so on and so forth and gets you to the target, obviously.
Yeah.
So... now, those flights, one thing I did realise, we seem to do, so when I said about the Jaguar's not sexy, but it does the job. It does what it's supposed to do.
You'll be getting hit in the comments for that one.
Yeah, yeah. But the Tornado was the same in principle. It didn't look like an F-16. It wasn't terribly... I think it looks great, but an F-16 sitting there, you know, you think, oh, that's that business, isn't it? You know, everybody wants to fly an F-16. But they had no range.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And the second thing was, if you started motoring a bit, some of these aircraft with low wing loadings didn't like it.
Mm.
Their speed was at height, but at low level, particularly F-15, didn't really like going really quickly, so you could pretty much outrun them, and you couldn't outrun an F-111, I have to say, but there we are, it's a different thing altogether. But the thing we found was we were accurate because of the chaff and flares and everything else. In the whole period we were there, we weren't shot down by anybody, which was amazing. We were accurate, and the other thing was we didn't run out of fuel like everybody else was doing. Everybody else, oh, we've got to get home now. Oh, fine, okay, we've got plenty of time. So it did the job, you know, but it wasn't the sort of sexy thing, really. But ask me what I'd have as an attack airplane, one of those, or an F-16.
Don't know.
Carries a lot, goes a long way, very accurate kit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way. So, and people were impressed there, obviously. Because nobody had ever seen one. In fact, one guy actually said to me, "You've got an Air Force?"
No, he didn't.
He did. Oh, wow. Oh, it was unbelievable. And but anyway, no, it did extremely well. It did extremely well. There was one occasion, and to be absolutely honest, it was complete luck. I was showing a senior officer, RAF senior officer, around, and he was guided by some senior people in the USAF. And we went into the ops room and he said, well, one of your boys is just coming through now. So, you know, his time on target is whatever it was, which was a minute from where we were. And so they had a big, one of these great big clocks that, you know, does this, that way around actually, up on the wall. And so I was sort of watching this and I was thinking, oh God, I hope he's on time and I hope, you know, he gets close to the target. And next thing was, as the top went like that, right by the target, and I thought, thank God for that. And so I smirked, and the senior guy turned around and said, oh, it's pretty good. I said, yeah, we do that all the time.
It's normal.
It's normal. Yeah, so did well. Yeah, it was a great aeroplane and showed its colours, basically.
And how often would you be, was this a daily fly-in? Would it be once a day, twice a day?
I'm trying to think now. Each guy would fly once a day, I would guess. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back. They started fairly early and went through the day. And of course, it's all desert, pretty much. You know, weather's going to be good all the time. So we did a lot of flying. Yeah.
And can you talk us through the briefs and debriefs? Were they more thorough than they would be back at home training?
Well, what happened was they asked us and themselves, they would pick a guy to run the daily briefing of the whole shooting match. Now, I, being the boss, I was never asked to do that, so I'm not entirely sure what went on. Yeah. But I think they were helped by the ops people there and everything else, and they ran the briefing for the whole shooting match, all 100-odd airplanes. So the briefings came there, and so I'm not entirely sure how it went. The debriefs was probably done in offices, you know. So, as I say, I didn't actually do that much flying. Now, one of the things about the debrief, there may well be a crew debrief or a section debrief. However, what they did do was they had a debrief at the end of every day. So you went into this massive auditorium with a huge screen, and they went through, not everything, but they went through various bits and bobs. So you saw yourself, and also on there you could see what the radar operator could see. So when a tornado came through, you just saw blank. Well, it was dark. It just blanked the whole thing off, the whole radar. So all this sort of thing was pretty evident. We didn't have to say anything. And you were on time and you were accurate. So, you know, anybody who's watching, you don't have to tell them that. It's evident. And a number of people came and said, didn't really know much about the tornado, but hey, good on you.
Yeah, I mean, did you ever swap notes with the F-111 guys? Kind of similar role, did you?
Do you know, we didn't.
Oh,
no.
Really? I thought you'd be a lot of note swapping between different crews, airframes, to see what you can get out of it. No.
No, not really. I think because you were either there and flying and doing your bits and bobs, or you, don't forget, it's Las Vegas. So you were all legging it downtown. Yes, I must say, absolutely hated Las Vegas from that thing. I just thought, what an awful place.
Really?
Until some years later, when I was airline flying, I went there for a week, just by the way it worked out. And that was fantastic. I was obviously in, you know, horrible town, and then I was secondly in the middle of town, and it was fantastic. I'd go anytime. Really fantastic. Yeah, all too much, but nicely done.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said, like, you didn't socialise with any of the nations, the Americans or whoever else.
I don't think it was just us and the USAF. I don't recall any other nations there at that time.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I want to ask you as well, what was the transit like coming from the UK? That must have been quite a pain in the bum to fly and even plan.
Right. Now, of course, air-to-air refueling, yeah, you've got to do that. Now, the planning, it was interesting because the planning was not done by any of the tornadoes. We were told what was going to happen.
Oh.
Right. And that was done by people who specialised in planning at the headquarters, and they liaised with the tanker people, which was on the same base, as it so happens. It might not be.
Yeah.
And so they planned that route. And you'd think, well, okay, the tornado at high level can go 2,000 miles or whatever it is. If it's 2001, we'll have one refueling. But it doesn't work like that. Mm. What they're doing all the time is to make sure you're topped up enough to divert. So the way it works for the tornado crews is you then go into the station briefing room where you are briefed on how it's going to be. Now, you're all refueling qualified, so, you know, that's fine. And then off you go. Now, it so happens, because they're on base, we can catch up with them pretty quickly, you know, and do that. And so quite often, as happened on one occasion with me, you were refueling just the north of Scotland. But that was to make sure you're topped up for a bit further down the route. And the other thing that everybody's always concerned about is that you break a probe.
Mm.
Now, if you break a probe, you can't get the fuel, you might even be losing fuel. So they always had that in mind. And it does bring me to one question, because you do ask me sort of, you know, any interesting things. Well, on this occasion, north of Scotland, coming for the refueling, right, okay. So, and it's all done very, very slowly and carefully. So I'm getting myself sorted out. And just as I get into the basket, into the basket, and there's somebody on the other side, into the basket, we're going to cloud.
No.
Well, okay, so far so good. At that point, I could still see the air. Well, we went, it was so thick, I really couldn't see the aeroplane. All I could see was the wing and the basket. And the thing is, you can't get out because you don't know where everybody is, you know. And so I was just sitting there, and then Nav was going, "Oh my God, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, don't worry, I'm still, I can still see enough." And he's, yeah. But that was horrible because it lasted quite a long time. But then, anyway, you do so many refuelings, and then eventually you land at Nellis Air Force Base. Did we stop on the way? I'm sure we must have done. I'm guessing, because otherwise that would have been a huge.
Yeah, I'm going to say that would be long.
12 hours or something. Yeah, we must have stopped.
Maybe Goose Bay, I think, is that on the way, maybe? Like
Goose Bay, yeah, it could well have been.
Yeah.
Stay the night and then crack on. And then land at Nellis, which is huge, a massive airport.
Mm.
Well, it's, you know, fighter pilot place, you know, lots happen there. And fantastic training. It's the sort of training we couldn't possibly do in the UK, just too much logistics. We don't have the area either to do it.
Yeah. And I always think Nellis Air Force Base is such a big base. When you landed, how did you know where to go? Was it easy to know where, or did you have a car in front of you?
No. Actually, from that perspective, it wasn't that difficult.
Oh, really?
I mean, there are two big runways, but I mean, it's obvious that you come off and go here, and then there's a massive pans, and you just park in there. No, I don't recall that as a problem. I know what you're saying. Places like Heathrow and whatever.
Yeah.
Don't know where you're going, but it was fairly straightforward.
Yeah. So overall, did you enjoy your time at Green Flag? And what were the few things that stuck out from that exercise for you?
Well, it was fantastic. Really enjoyed it. It was great flying. The sort of flying you couldn't possibly do anywhere else. And to see your... I think the biggest thing that came to me was our equipment works. Not only that, it works really well. I was absolutely amazed by that. I don't know why, and we'd all got the impression that, because you can't check it very well. You can go to Spade Adam Range, but it's difficult to get feedback and so on about what's happening. So that helped, and the fact of the chaff and flare dispensers, and the whole business of listening, and you very quickly started picking up where aircraft were, who they were, whether they were locked on to you, what they could do. And the fact of the matter remains, whereas with missiles and things, and sort of people just firing into the air, like the Vietnamese did or whoever, then you don't want to be at low level. But if you've got an air-to-air missile up you, actually it's a good place to be.
Mm.
Because if you're that close to the ground, you know, the chances are it'll hit the ground before it hits you. And you get this whole feel for the battle. And the other thing was the work load and how it went with the pilot navigator when it was really needed.
Mm.
When it was really needed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I went to Scotland on a low-level Navex or something, then I've got a moving map. I've got all the kit. I know what I'm doing. And I thought I was doing quite well, you know, being a single seat guy and working with the navs, until one day I was at Jerby Range and I said, so what do you think, 2700 to get back? And he said, well, if you knew, why are you asking? Oh, right, okay, reset. I'm not doing as well as I thought I was. But working as a team and it became evident in Nellis, you know, it was in a way that normal flying, it's not quite as evident.
Yeah, absolutely, So let's talk about the SAC bombing competition.
Yeah.
How did this come about, and do you have to put like your name in, as it were, or were you invited?
No, I got a phone call from the Grand Fromage way up there somewhere, who said, you're going to do the SAC bomb comp and get on with it. Win. So that was that. Now, What had happened was the previous year, 617 Squadron, they were the first to do it, and they'd done very well. And so I thought, oh, because I'm not bothered about beating the Americans. Well, we do want to beat them. So anyway, so we just set to it. Now, what I will say is, you know, sometimes, you know, Air Force isn't particularly ours, you know, can skimp here and there, and you think, well, you know, can we have a bit more effort somewhere? None of that happened. We had everything to help us.
Brilliant.
To do this. Yeah, absolutely. Now, we did all the donkey work and all that stuff, but we were left with nothing wanting anyway. Also, we had, the company had a big vested interest in this. BAE.
Oh, BAE,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So they had a vested interest. So we had a lot of help from them. And, for example, one of their test navigators was with us the whole time. Not so much at Marham, where we were based, but once we got out. And the sort of thing he'd do, for example, I never understood with the navigators. You'd get navigator A saying, well, when it's this sort of target, I like to do this and this and this and fiddle with that. And the other guy said, well, I tend to use this, that, and that. And I kept thinking, there's got to be a good way to do each of these things, you know. All right. But I'm not arguing with the navs.
Yeah.
No. So, but what he did was he came and he said, right, these are the targets. I know all the intricacies of the radar and how it works. Texas Instruments, incidentally. So this is the way to do it. So we had him and probably two or three others. We also had, oddly, but it made a big difference in the end, people from Ordnance Survey. We had a couple of people from Ordnance Survey who came with us. Now, I think ostensibly they were there to verify that the targets were that people said they were, and they were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's no problem there. However, what they did do was they came back and said, these maps are, oh, I don't know, whatever it was, 1916, or no, probably a bit later than that, 1940s maps, something like that. But it's a desert. You know, nobody cares. Once they're done, and that's it. And they're accurate enough for government work, frankly. So I'm not decrying that, but they said they don't have the equipment that we have, and we're telling you that there's 116 feet in error on a couple of the targets. And I think in other target areas, something similar.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't sound much, but you know, when you're dropping a bomb from 17 grand, which is what they were doing, then you know, things like that make a big difference.
Absolutely, yeah.
So knowing that, okay. So what we did was we said, okay, we're going to work up the crews. We're going to work up 8 crews. We're going to end up with 2 lots of 2, and then on the when we get there, we will end up with 6 crews, and then we've got a, you know, 2 crews spare. But everybody gets a go. Now, bearing in mind, this is navigator stuff. This is back to where I was saying in Green Flag. This is, you are driver's airframe Mark 1. That's it. Most of the flight is done on autopilot, so you know, you're just sitting there looking out the window. You do the difficult bit, and certainly you do some tanking at night, and the weather's not very nice. You earn your money. But all of the rest of it is down to the nav. So it was how the navigator operated and how he did his job, was which is why you got how you chose what they did. So what there are various ways with stats, and you've got to be careful. So if you say, well, we'll take an average of all the bombs, well, that's a stat, and you know, some people would be better than others. Or you say, we'll take the first bomb. Every first bomb you carry, that's the one we'll carry, because that's how the competition is.
Right.
Okay? Or you say, what we'll do is we'll take the last 50%. And the reason for that is, you're showing the improvement from here. So you're juggling all these things. And they are learning how to use the radar in the way that BAE says they should do it. So that was that. We did a lot of sorties. Bearing in mind, these are 5.5-hour, six-hour sorties. So, yeah. So we've got to do that, and we've got to refuel, which nobody else has to do. I've forgotten three times in that period.
Yeah.
You had to refuel, and so the pilot earned his money doing that. Now, on the aeroplane side, we didn't modify it for performance, but we did have to modify it for the competition, like tones and IFF and stuff like that. But what we also did was we flew all the aircraft and all the major components, the bits we were really interested in, we noted down on 0-9 marking system how they operated. And if you keep doing that, you get the personality of the aeroplane. So that's it. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that all aeroplanes have, Tornado is no different, you get an inertial nav system, brakes. It's not good. We've got, okay, not to worry, we'll send it back, get it refixed, put a new one in, whatever. Later on, this one comes back, all refurbished on the line. But not always, but quite often, same fault will come up later on. So we got rid of those. Anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
So that was the aeroplane. And we just kept doing that. And we whittled off, who was going to do it and so on. And at the end of the day, there were the six crews there. And you couldn't put a paper between them, frankly. Mm. I just put the winning crews, if you like, and then the spare up on a board, and I said, look, as far as I'm concerned, any one of these crews, I will have the same confidence at all. So, it was a paper, that much was the difference. And so that's it. That's how we chose the crews. And the aircraft we monitored very, very carefully. The one thing that happened was that... I'll mention this now, slightly out of sequence. One of the things that we had a problem with was the bomb carrier, which carried four little practice bombs. For some reason, suddenly, they were not dropping the first bomb, but they did click over to the next one. So they knew about it. The system knew, but it didn't drop the bomb.
Right.
So we thought, right. And the last Saturday before before the competition started, I said to right, we're going to go to the range. We're going to drop every one carrier. If carriers are okay, we're going to lock them. We're going to, and so that was that. So I was very miffed when on one of them, the bomb held up, and that was the one. If it hadn't been for that, we'd have won all three prizes.
Really?
First and second. Yeah. But as it was, that just that one thing. You lose a lot of points. And in fact, some wag who knows better than I, even when that happened, we knew it happened before they got back, and somebody said, no, we can still just do it. Well, it was too much. So we came second. But,
That's still something.
Yeah.
What other aircraft were you actually up against? Was it the F-111? Were the B-52s there?
B-52, F-111.
Yeah. How did they, I'm guessing, were they annoyed that you were so good?
No, because they didn't know until the final night. So there were some issues there. We got accused of cheating, and we eventually had we got some, because we went to the sites, and all we wanted to do was to make sure they were correct. We're allowed to. We checked all this stuff, obviously.
Yeah.
This and that. But, of course, we did find out about the height on some of them. So that was that. And then, mysteriously, flight plans would go missing. Your range slots would be gone. What? And we had a guy who spent a lot of time in the States, and he said, it's difficult to say whether it's them doing it or incompetence.
That's
or
very petty if it was.
Well, if it was. The only thing I would say, and... And again, I just can't understand why they would do this. This is SAC, and it's a SAC at base. On the day of our first takeoff, which was a day flight, when they taxied out, there was a B-52 sitting on the runway at the threshold. And they sat, and in the end, we've got times to make. Can we take off from the intersection. We're fine with that. There's an alert, and he's sitting on the alert. Oh, well, all right. Well, so they, after a lot of faffing about, they allowed them to take off from the intersection, and we thought, no, surely they didn't do that. But on the other hand, it's SAC. They know their bomb competition is on. Why do they throw an alert at that moment? Anyway, that was that.
Did you win trophies or medals or anything like that?
Not personally. No, right. No, nobody got a personal thing. I've got a photo, which I think you've got, showing that the big, huge.
Oh yes, of course, yeah.
Trophies that they have, yeah. You won those. 617 were. They'd also won two, but I don't think they won the third. It was very, very, very close, frankly. But we did beat them.
Yeah.
What happened was we had low level dropping bombs at low level, and times to accuracy and times and so on. Incidentally, on times, I remember, if you put all the times together of our crews where they were timed, the accuracy is 1/3 of 1 second.
Ooh, wow.
So they were pretty accurate. They trained for a long time to do this, but anyway, still pretty good. So you're dropping bombs at low level, but the one thing we had never done was dropping bombs from high level. So we'd have to practice that in the UK. It was $17,000. And so the target was unseen. You couldn't physically see the target. And so what we had to do was offset bombing, as it were. The way that sort of works, I mean, it works in normal time anyway, in an airplane like the Tornado, you pick something sort of fairly big, perhaps not a town, but maybe a village, to make sure, right, well, we know that's accurate. So that brings the system in a bit. Then you go to somewhere with perhaps a bit bigger, a factory or something. Oh yeah, we've got that. And the idea is you just keep making the accuracy better and better and better, and then eventually you bomb blind. So that's what they did. Now, dropping for $17,000, there's all sorts of bits and bobs that go on, not least of which, what do they call it now? D-factor. D-factor, as far as I understand it, because I've never heard of it before, was the difference between what the aeroplane thought the ambient pressure was going down from $17,000 to what it actually is. So suddenly you've got a situation where the one thing that all the crews are sitting with the Met man was as he goes through these pressures, because then we worked out some algorithm to take it out so the aeroplane could sort it out. So that's one thing. Then it's really to show you how much effort went into this. One of the other things we did was the nav system to update it. It was only one decimal place, but it was the actual airplane was accurate to two decimal places. So you could have, it's not much, there's a bit of error there. So what we did was we found points on the deck, which were to one decimal place, and then put the airplane on that. So then we knew. And so the airplanes were sort of like this on the pan, but they were on specific slots. And as I say, the nav guy was very good, and he just helped everybody with all the sort of navigation. Not the navigation, it's the bomb aiming, really, and the intricacies of that. So, yeah, we put a lot of effort in. But it paid off.
It sounds like you had a lot of fun over there, though. It must have been a great time for you all.
Yeah. Well, it was because we were there for quite a while before we actually, we did practice. We were allowed to do practice runs and all this sort of business. And then they had this massive, absolutely massive hall. You can imagine all the B-52s and everything else. Yeah. They're all coming from other places, but all the crews were there. A lot of them were there. And then they gave out the prizes, and the RAF came out, Royal Air Force Cruiser again. But it made us feel good, because he won't know who, he'll never watch this. But there was a guy that stood up before we started, and he was one of these sort of guys. I don't know if he had a Stetson and a cigar, but maybe not, but you're getting the picture of this guy. And he harangued everybody about, there's no such thing as second. They're just losers, or just bloody losers, And he went through this. Funnily enough, he didn't come and give the prizes when the end came up. I thought, oh, right, okay, no losers then.
That's brilliant stuff.
Anyway, so there we are. Yeah, it was, we put a lot of effort in, it paid off. People were cock-a-hoop. We couldn't, well, short of that bomb, that was the only thing that stopped us.
Really. It's pretty incredible, though, yeah. That tiny one mishap.
Yeah, yeah. And especially since we'd made all the effort. Because when on that Saturday, when we went, guys were grumbling. They said, come on, boss, you know, it's Saturday, you know, give us a break.
Yeah.
I said, no, we've got to do this. And so, anyway, it didn't work, so that's
brilliant
fine.
Stuff.
So towards the end of all this, BAE, who obviously cock-a-hoop about it, and they invited us all round for lunch and so on, all the crews and everything else, that's fantastic. And I said to the chief test pilot, now, do you want me to give a talk on this? And then he said, no, relax, mate, you know, it's just a lunch, you know, this will be fine. And then when I got there, he said, it wasn't him actually, it was somebody else. He said, do you mind giving a talk to a couple of the guys that just wanted to ask about the questions, you know, about how it went and so on? Said, yeah, yeah. So walk into this auditorium, about 200 people. Oh, Jesus. The only saving grace is you learn, when you're a boss of an outfit, you learn always to have boxes of slides in your pocket, as was in those days. But the only thing I was going to say about that, one guy asked a very pertinent question, and he said, if there was one thing that you would, you know, you'd really hang your hat on, what would it be? And I said, reliability, that is the thing. Because I said, all the equipment in the aeroplane was more than enough to win that competition, but you've got to be reliable. It so happened, all the aircraft were reliable and they all went off, because if they didn't go, that was it. There was no spare,
yeah, exactly.
At that instant.
Yeah.
No. So, no, they all went and they all did the job and everything else. But that bomb, and that was the thing. And I said, that's what you've got to go for, reliability. Tornado ejection. This flight was in Canada, in Goose Bay, and we were going to the north of the base to do some attacks, and the F4Es that were there, German F4Es, they came and they said, well, we'll defend. So that was it. So that really had no bearing on this, but that was the start of it. So we come into the circuit, not hugely a lot of fuel, and turned downwind, and what happened was, down on the left-hand side, I think it was, there were some buttons, and they were little square push-type buttons, and they were to do with the fly-by-wire system.
Right.
And so that was a sort of like a two-stage system in some way, I don't quite recall. So you press, what happened is if it came out, you were then into the next system. No big deal. But to get rid of it, you just pressed it. So pressed it, gone. But I thought, something not quite right here, lads. And I was downwind, and then I noticed the flap hadn't come out. Slats had come out, but no flap. So I thought, right, okay. Now, of course, the swept wing, so 27 wing, it needs to be in 27, because if it's anything other than that, then the flaps go into the fuselage.
Of course, yeah.
So obviously, there's a microswitch. I'm not sure if a microswitch is the right word, but there we are.
We'll
there's something
that.
In there to stop all this happening. So I thought, well, okay, I'll sweep the wings to, you know, a bit more, so 29 or something, and then just bang it, see if I can bang it forward a few times. No, wasn't having any of it. Okay, so we're running short of fuel. By this stage, I've done a couple of circuits to let everybody else land, because I told them I had a problem. And so I was now left with no trailing edge flap, but I did have the slats. No big deal, just land quicker. And in the tornado, you were landing on angle of attack, so the speed, in a sense, was immaterial. But all it would meant that I'd be landing 10 or 15 knots, perhaps more. And it was quite slow in the tornado, 120 knots or something like that. So, you know, it's no big deal, really, with a great big runway. So, anyway, I did this circuit, and coming around the circuit, that was fine. And somewhat later in the process, the aircraft just rocked slightly, just a little like that. Turbulence, don't know, didn't seem much. But it soon, directly after that, the whole thing didn't feel right. It was yawing in one sense, but it was also rolling and yawing at the same time. And it was just an uncomfortable feeling, and I was trying to sort of stop it doing it. Anyway, I thought, because I'd seen it in Hunter, that it was Dutch rolling.
Mm.
And I thought, that speed isn't right. I mean, all this I'm about to describe to you happened in about 3 seconds, by the way. So I'm thinking, Dutch rolling, okay, let's get out of here. So I put both heaters in to get away from it. And I thought, okay, next time round, instead of landing at 12 units, I'll land at 10 or 8 or something. And that's what was going in my head. But by the time I'd got those heaters in, ground very close down here, I've got full control this way, aeroplane rolling that way. I thought, no, time, Martin Baker, thank you very much. So I pulled the handle, and that's no big, it's not an issue, because yes, you have a navigator, but it's command ejection. So either of you can pull the other one out. So if I pull the handle, he's going to go. And he also goes before the pilot, mm-hmm. the nav. And it's 0.6 of a second. So, it's absolutely the square root of sod all. Well, I sat and sat and sat. I read the War and Peace, most of the Bible, and everything. I thought, I've had it, because it's not worked.
Yeah.
Next thing was, woof, off I go. The one thing I was surprised about, I was expecting a bang like that. It wasn't. It was an absolute smooth thing. Now, just the way it works is you have a tiny cartridge. It's amazing. Just to lift the seat up a bit, there's a lanyard attached to a rocket, and so which is on the floor. So when you go past a certain point, off the rocket goes, and that's 5,000 pounds of thrust for half a second. Now, bearing in mind, little me and a seat, probably 300 pounds, I don't know, something like that. So 5,000 pounds of thrust is quite a lot. So off we go. And I remember being on my back, and I could feel all the straps undoing, and because it's all automatic.
Oh, you could feel that.
Oh yeah, I could feel them all. Okay. Until eventually, Christ, thank God for that. I'm in the chute, and I'm thinking, right, okay. Now what? Side left. I was thinking back to my parachute days when I was 19 years old when I joined the Air Force. Too late. Doof, hit the ground. And when I say the ground, it was the runway. So, right on the runway. So that was that. And then I was sitting there, and interesting this, because it's because of this, when I taught my daughter to drive, I remember this precise thing, what I'm trying to get at is, you more often than not remember what you were very first taught. So when times get tough, that's what you remember, not what you were taught subsequently.
Mm.
And that goes. So I was taught in the years gone by with one of those type parachutes. You undo it and then press the back of the box and the thing all opens. And I've been flying with these what they call cock fasteners. There are fasteners which have come here for years, but no, what did I do? Went for this box. I went for the release box.
That's interesting.
Anyway, 2 seconds or something. All right, okay. So I got rid of that. So that was that. Now I'm sitting there and I'm hearing all this roaring noise, and I look up, and there's my Tornado in a vertical climb like this. And of course, the reheats are in, because that's how I left the airplane. I wasn't going to faff about there, I was off. And off it went, and I watched it crash in the distance eventually, and so that was that. One of the funny things that happened, and I'll go back to why the actual ejection happened, one of the funny things that happened was everybody else was in, taxiing in, and there was a huge, I don't know if you've been to Goose Way, I've seen pictures of it, massive pan, absolutely huge. And of course, all these guys are taxiing in, and all of a sudden they see doof, doof, these seats go, and this airplane, and to them, it's directly above.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, they know full well it's not going to do that,
yeah,
it can't do it, but nevertheless, they're thinking, and apparently it's like Fred Karno's circus, there were airplanes. all over the place like this, chattering around. And one guy said, he said to the captain, he was a navigator, and he said to the captain, slow down, mate. And then saw another airplane go past him like a rocket like this and everything else. And it was just a whole bunch of guys trying to get out of the way of this bloody airplane. That happened to a German test pilot some years before, and he created and said, oh, this is unacceptable and blah, blah. And I think they all had a chat about it and decided it probably wasn't going to happen or something. Anyway, they either didn't do anything about it or not much. And the upshot was that the flaps were out, and of course I had the flap lever down as well. But the slats... the flaps weren't out, but the slats were, but I had the lever down, obviously, because I'm trying to get the damn thing down. And it's a fly-by-wire airplane. The computer got confused. And what it thought was, well, my flaps are down. So therefore, I will give the forces required. And they had what they called a maneuver demand system in the airplane. It was brilliant because it was so... What it really meant, manoeuvre demand, was if you had wing stores, you know, full of wing stores, and you wanted to do that, you wanted to turn at a certain rate, it would be the same in your hand, you know, for the stick, as if the wings were clean.
Mm.
So that was manoeuvre demand. So it was the manoeuvre you wanted. And what this system did was it thought, all right, okay, so the flaps are down, therefore I will give this sort of amount of stick requirement. But the flaps were up. And so with the flaps down, you'd need more control. As it was, if you did that, more control, the wing just went, and every time I tried to correct it, it was doing this. Now, as I said, the whole thing took 2 or 3 seconds, so I didn't have time. And so that was the reason it ended up like this. And the upshot of it was, because we had stores on the airplane, that didn't help because it was the momentum of that. So that was the reason. What they did subsequently was they said, right, if this situation happens and the wind is above X, first thing you do is get rid of all the stores. So that stops that issue. And if at any point it gets worse than that, you consider ejecting rather than, because in this particular case, what happened was that aircraft went like that and way over the distance it landed. Now, had that been Marham, that would have gone right in my quarter, probably.
Wow.
Yeah. That's, so you don't want airplanes just skidding around, not under control. So that's why it happened. They took steps subsequently to stop it happening. Now, the other thing that happened on the ejection was, and I'm not sure if I told you last time, but the AIB man, it was AIB in those days, he rang me up and said, want to know what height your seat left the airplane? And I said, yeah, go up 100 feet, 200 feet. He said, 12. 12 feet? I said, what?
12 feet?
He said, your seat actually left the airplane at 12 feet above the ground. I have to say, it didn't appear to be that close. But and the navigator, he also disputed it. He said 100 feet maybe.
12,
but he's the guy with all the numbers. So.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happened was I broke my collarbone, and that was, we think, because as the seat goes out, the oxygen bottle that was there went up and underneath the collarbone and broke it, we think. And the other thing that happened was that this leg, from top to bottom, was black and blue and yellow and I don't know what. Felt okay, but it just looked terrible. It just looked like, I don't know, meat, you know. It was horrible, blood everywhere, but inside. And he then told me why that was. He said, you're so lucky your leg is still on, mate. And the reason was that everything undoes on the seat, and we also have leg restrainers that come like this. And one of those leg restrainers got just, it's like a little V connector thing. Mm. And one of them just got caught in the D-ring. So when the seat fell away, this thing was caught on my leg, and then it snapped. the cord snapped. £5,000 braking strain. So how my leg is still on, I have no idea.
So do you have any long-term like sufferings or illnesses from the ejection at all, or are you generally
no,
okay?
No, we're all checked as it was. And of course, rocket seat makes a big difference because the peak G is much less. We went to Nocton Hall, I think it was, and got checked out. They put some stuff in our blood and checked it, and it was fine. The only thing was my leg. I could walk on it and everything else, but it was that the knee was quite stiff and sore. Mm. And now, oddly, much older than I was, and my knee is beginning to give me a little bit of grief. But it's been a long time, 40 plus years.
So. Well, John, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
You're very welcome.